a friend of mine, I told him that I was coming this morning because I was busily rereading Francis' book. And he said, let me get this straight. You're going to go talk to a room full of bright people about the lifetime book of a brilliant 78-year-old Jesuit who just happens to be the most popular person on this planet. Good luck with that. To which another friend said, it's all right, Joe. He's only 3 years older than you are, so go on. I begin this morning by reading one of the principles of our Unitarian Church. Respect for the independent web of all existence of which we are a part. Pause for a second here. This is to keep me from getting carried away. We hope. And this is to... What holds us together is not a creed. It's the seven principles of action. And although in the list that's usually the one at the bottom, sometimes referred to as the seventh principle, reminding everybody that principles are like the spokes of a wheel. They're all equally important, and there's no one, but you turn the wheel depending on what you need to focus on now. I think it would be not at all an exaggeration to say that Francis' new encyclical could be called the encyclical of the seventh principle. There's probably never been a major writing put together by a major religious leader which deals so comprehensively and inclusively with the seventh principle as this new work, which is one of the reasons why I think you're going to all find it a really interesting. I found it interesting. I found it most unusual. It's certainly a most unusual encyclical. It's extremely well written, and it has a lot of richness. As I read it, The major theme tying the whole book together is that everything is interrelated. Now, he doesn't use the word interdependent. He talks of things as being interrelated, our interrelationship with each other, with the creative force, God, and with nature. And that trinity of interrelationships among ourselves, with our earth and nature, and with the creative force. The whole piece is built around that, and the challenges that we now face to the destructive forces that are loose, undermining the three of those. I can't tell you, I can't tell you what Francis says in this book. It is quite a piece. I will say that he's been working on it for his whole life. And I'm reminded of a story I heard about Matisse when he was in his older years, and he had a nice painting. It was a wealthy man and his wife visiting, interested in buying a painting. He had put a pretty hefty price tag on it, and the businessman, after looking at it, said, Well, how long did it take you to paint this thing? You want this much money. And Matisse said, a lifetime. A lifetime. And that's what we have here. We have something that, how long did it take Francis to write this book? A lifetime. Now, he's in a very good situation. He doesn't need to find a publisher. The Vatican has its own press. and they have done they have done a wonderful thing. The book is free. They've put a PDF form out, and it's on the website, and it's free to everyone in the world who can download onto their computer or their Kindle or their iPhone or whatever, a PDF file. Which means, I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that we can be quite sure that by Christmas time it will have been read by 100 million people, maybe more. So that's quite a bully pulpit. And so what I want to do is just identify some things that I like about it and a couple of things that may help you in reading it, which I very much hope you will do. There's much for anyone who believes in the seventh principle. There's much there for us to like, and it's very supportive, which is good news. I'm reminded of the fact that, you know, if you look back at the Second World War, it took a long time for the United States to get involved in that war. Canada had been war for almost 2 years before America got involved. But it was really very helpful when America became involved. And it's very helpful to have strong allies. Stalin notoriously said one time, disparagingly, of the Pope, how many divisions does he have? Well, actually, if you think in terms of supporters rather than divisions, Francis has a lot. And he's making a determined and conscious effort. He says explicitly that one of the reasons he's writing this to is to encourage Catholics and other Christians and other believers of other faiths to come together and recognize the seriousness of our situation and what we can do together to work about it. As I read it, I think a key idea in the book is, I would say, harmony. You might think in terms of interdependence and harmony as kind of the left hand and the right hand go together. Disharmony is in effect, it's the cancer of interdependence. When things happen that begin to undermine harmony, then the interdependence starts to fracture. And become corrupted. Now, in biblical and in religious language, this is called sin. And I mention that because he does use the sin word. He doesn't use it a lot, very sparingly, but very deliberately. What he means by that, there's many, many confusing notions of sin, but sin is fundamentally, in a Catholic perspective, sin is disharmony. When disharmony breaks out among us, or between us and with nature, or between us and the creative force, that's what is meant by sin. And a good example is if you look at the Ten Commandments. The Ten Commandments are simply a list of things that if we do them, they create disharmony. When you steal from people, or when you covet other people's property, or things like this, that creates the disharmony. So, I just mention that because sometimes the use of the word sin is off-putting to people because they think of it in terms of offending a God. Well, that's not the point. The point is that a sin is something which creates disharmony, that disharmony is the problem. So I'll just use Catholics as a prototype of, as an example of Christians, because that's the other churches I'm very much involved in. We've always put a major focus on the disharmony, the things that cause disharmony between people. And there's been a major focus on the things that cause disharmony with our God. What's unusual and what's very new about this encyclical is it's primarily devoted to the problem of disharmony with Mother Earth or with nature. And so in a sense it's an expansion of the notion of sin. Now, at the beginning, in a minute I'm going to take a little look at the beginning. At the beginning, he, after explaining what he wants to do, he points to Pope John Paul, Pope John XXIII, the previous Pope Benedict, and then to St. Francis of Assisi, of course. He works briefly with five people, and then most surprisingly with Patriarch Bartholomew of the Patriarch of the Orthodox Church. This is just another example of the innovativeness and boldness of this encyclical. This is surely the first time that the Patriarch of the Orthodox Church has been grouped with two saints, three saints, and the previous pope in the presentation. And he does this because of the very, very important role Bartholomew has played in many of our lives. Bartholomew was the first of the major Catholic Orthodox patriarchs and leaders to emphasize that the degradation of the earth was sinful. In other words, to begin using the language of this is not just an economic problem. He says quite explicitly in here, let me just take a second to prepare. For human beings to destroy the biological diversity of God's creation, to degrade the integrity of the earth by stripping it of its natural forests or destroying its wetlands, for human beings to contaminate the waters, its land, its air, its life, these are sins. Now that's a tone, because that's all connected with the notion that our earth is sacred. And that has always, there's always been a chord. You know, I deliberately, he uses St. Francis' Hymn of the Creatures right at the very beginning. And I asked them to read it this morning because the emphasis that the earth is sacred because it's so life-giving. So this is, there was, in the early Middle Ages, a green movement. Francis of Assisi, Hildegard of Bingen, Meister Eckhart, Juliana of Norwich. For reasons that we won't get into here, that kind of died down. It never disappeared. It was always a minor chord. And it's been a minor chord in some of the other writings of church leaders. But for the Catholic Church, this has not been a major chord. So this has been a huge and important change. So now, an encyclical. Here it is. As you can see, even bound with two pages, it's pretty substantial. The encyclical letter Laudatio Si of the Holy Father Francis on care for our common home. Encyclical letter, from cyclical, the idea was send this letter around to all the bishops and people. That's how the idea started. And one of the things that I want to just read the first paragraph. Laudatio si, mene signore, praise be to you, my Lord. In the words of this beautiful canticle, Francis of Assisi reminds us that our common home is like a sister with whom we share our life, and a beautiful mother who opens her arms to embrace us. Praise be to you, my Lord, through our sister, Mother Earth, who sustains us and governs us and produces various fruits with colored flowers and herbs. That's new language for us. And I think that it's a very good way to start this off. Gives you a sense of where he's going with it. Now, the book is very beautifully logical. This is the writing of a Jesuit. This is very... This is a beautifully tied together. It's 183 pages as it comes out on the Vatican Press, and it's 246 numbered paragraphs. The beauty of it is, I used to teach English, the beauty of it is the man knows how to write paragraphs. So, there's a topic, right? And you write what you want to say about that. And then if there's another topic, you have another paragraph. So when you go through here, you know, there aren't any numbered sections that are more than about two-thirds of a page, which is very, very helpful, because it's managing to read that and say, okay, and get hold of that. And then it's very well tied together. So this is something that I really liked about it, because of the fact that it's so well crafted that increases the chances that more people will read it and reread it and digest it. It's also an important style change, in the sense that when I was working as a writer, when we were putting out documents from the government, I used to insist that these had to make sense to the people on the bus. You know, I rode the bus into work. The bus was full of very bright people. We had professional secretaries to professional managers. And my image was, I used to say, imagine that it's a snowstorm and the bus is stuck for 3 hours on the Bedford Highway, so nobody has anything to do, so you pass this out. It has to make sense to the people on the bus. And he's definitely tried very hard to do that, and with great success. Not complete success. At one point, he gets very keen on the word paradigm, and he keeps talking about a paradigm. I'm not sure that the people on the bus are... I would have used maybe a little bit looser term, like mindset. But other than that, I think you're going to find it very readable. So he goes on then, second paragraph says, Sister Earth now cries out to us, because of the harm we have inflicted on her by our irresponsible use and abuse of the goods with which God has endowed her. We have come to see ourselves as lords and masters, entitled to plunder her at will. Then he says, more than 50 years ago, John the 23rd wrote an encyclical about nuclear threat of war, and he addressed it to the Catholic world and to all men and women of goodwill. Now, faced as we are with global environmental deterioration, I wish to address every person living on this planet. I would like to enter into dialogue with all people about our common home. And then he says, I urgently appeal then for a new dialogue about how we are shaping the future of our planet. We need a conversation which includes everyone, since the environmental challenge we are undergoing and its roots and concerns affect us all. Everyone's talents and involvements are needed to redress the damage caused by human abuse of creation. So this is also groundbreaking in the sense that it's a very deliberate attempt by him to reach out as the leader of one of the world's religions to reach out to everyone. And I think you'll, when you see that, he means it, and as a result, it's not, in many senses, it's not full of a lot of Catholic religious language. He's made a very serious attempt to put it into. Now, I want to just take a second here. In an odd, for some reason, the Vatican Press puts the table of contents at the end of the book. Anyway, it's their book. So. But I just want to briefly tell you what he has broken down in the six sections. The first section, what is happening to our common home? What is happening? This is his attempt to get a hold of what's the situation that we're in. And it's almost a fourth of the book. And this is where a lot of the science and anthropology and so forth comes in, because he takes up huge numbers of topics. He has a paragraph on pollution, on climate change, on warming, on water privatization, on the loss of biodiversity, on global inequality. He goes, you know, every environmental problem you can think of is touched here. Now, the one value of that is it pulls together in one compact place. You know, really, you could use this as a good item for having a discussion group about the problem, because he's trying to get us to see that all of these problems are interconnected. He also, this is where a lot of science comes in. And some might say, well, you know, who are you? You know, what is a bishop doing talking to us about all these scientific questions? I just would make two comments. One is that he didn't start out as a bishop. He started out before he even went to the seminary as a chemist. And then at one point, when he was teaching as a Jesuit at university, what he was teaching was organic chemistry, not theology. So we have here a man, I'm not putting him forward as a scientific guru. He would be the last to do that. But he knows how science works. He knows data and evidence and how that leads to hypotheses and theories and probabilities and myths. So he knows how science works and respects it. And the other thing is that he has working with him, it's called the Pontifical Academy of Sciences. And that's an extremely important group. The Vatican pulls people together, some of the top scientists and some of the Vatican Observatory, one of the top astronomers in the world is running the Vatican Observatory. So he has, working with him and giving advice, and he's a listener to a lot of people who really know what they're doing. Now, in that, there will be many items as you go through, or as any reader goes through, And that'll be jarring to say, well, you're saying this about climate change. He's very clear about that as he sees it, the dominance of scientific opinion at this point in time is that the climate is changing. And that we are having at least some role in this. And we need to face up to that. That's something that some people are going to be upset about when they read that. Another one is he talks about biodiversity. And he talks about, he lays out a scientific fact that the number of species is diminishing. He lays out as scientific fact the fact that this is potentially a great loss because of all of the gifts that those creatures might have been able to share with us will be lost, as a scientific proposal that the rate of extinction is increasing. And then he makes a value judgment. He makes value judgments here. And he says that this is flowing partially from this belief that as humans, we have the right to do whatever we wish to species. If we're going to do something and they're in the way, too bad for them. And then he sometimes does value affirmations. He says, we have no such right. Okay, now, I want to just make clear what the Catholic response will be. Because he's Pope and because he says that, that doesn't make it right. That doesn't mean that he's right when he says, we have no right to do this. Thomas Aquinas said 900 years ago, the argument from authority is the weakest of all arguments. The weakest of all arguments is to say, this is true because George said so. This is true because the Pope said so. That's not what's going on here. He's making a value judgment in the context of wanting to start a dialogue. So he says, if you're going to have a dialogue, first you have to listen. So that's what this whole first chapter is. I'm listening to what the scientists are saying, and this is what they're saying. Now, some will say, well, those scientists have it wrong. He said, in his opinion, the weight of evidence is that they have it right. So he's making a call there. He's making a judgment call. We're free to disagree with that. But he said, first in the dialogue you listen, and then in a dialogue, you state your position. And you state it clearly and honestly, and you don't use weasel words, and you don't use politically correct words. You just say what you honestly think. That's what you have to have dialogue. So, in this, as you read these paragraphs, every so often, you're going to encounter something that's jolting. I would say the people in this room are going to encounter fewer of them than some other people. Jeb Bush didn't get off to a very good start with the part on climate change because he doesn't like the idea that we're contributing to it. Okay. But it is going to happen no matter how much you agree with most of this book. At some point you're going to hit parts and they'll say, I don't like that. I don't agree. I don't buy that. So, when that happens, I have a proposal. Okay, and it goes back to my youth when I used to go out to the ballpark and watch Stan Musial play baseball. Stan Musial was one of the four or five best hitters in the history of baseball, and he was a shoo into the Hall of Fame. I mean, it 1 second after he was 5 years retired, he was elected to the Hall of Fame. Here's my point. Stan Musial's lifetime batting average was .333, which meant one third of the times he got up to bat, he got on base. The other two thirds, not so much. One third, if you get one third of the hits, you're a shoo-in for the Hall of Fame. It's So I apply this to books. I call it my Stan Musial rule. I pick up a book and I'm looking for the one third of that book that's right. Because no books are all right. No book by a pope is all right. He knows that. He says, you'll be amazed at the language. He doesn't say, this is the way it is. He doesn't pontificate. He does say what he honestly believes. We have no right. But he doesn't pontificate. He keeps saying, I would propose. I would like to suggest. I think it would be good if. Okay, you know, this is dialogue talk. So realize that these sections are all attempts to get a dialogue going, that he is listening, and that he is being honest, and that begins the dialogue. This doesn't end the dialogue for Catholics on this issue. This begins the dialogue among Catholics on this issue. So I think that's enough. I'll just close with two quick things. The second chapter is about the gospel of creation. And he starts off by saying, You're probably wondering why in the second chapter of a book addressed to all the people of the world, I want to talk about the gospel. And he gives a beautiful answer, which in a nutshell is, religions and science are going to have to work together on this stuff. We can't solve these problems by only taking one view of reality. We need to take into account all the views of reality which add, which help. And religion can help. The Catholic Church has never had the position that science and religion are at odds. I brought this book today. This is by the Catholic who headed up the genome project for common sakes. And he was asked, well, what did that do to your faith? And in this book he says, that strengthens my faith. So all the way back to Aquinas, the Vatican and Catholic teaching has been clear. Science and religion are not opposed to each other if they're done properly. Properly religion and proper science do not conflict. So he says, I'm writing this primarily so that the people of my church and other Christians and other believers will have additional motivation to get on side and start pushing the bus. Well now, how can you be against that? He's trying to get a billion people to get on side and start helping to push the bus. What if he only gets 1 out of 10? That's 100 million people of new allies. So I think you'll find it a fascinating look. It is to go along to the Pontifical Science Academy. There's a Pontifical Biblical Commission, which is made up of the best scripture scholars they can find. In fact, they just had a meeting, and they invited Dr. Craig Evans, who is one of the Dead Sea Scrolls experts of the world, who's a card-carrying Baptist teaching at Acadia University, and they invited him over because, you know, if you want to know about the Bible, you know, Baptists are good people to talk to. And it's an example of how inclusive it is. This little section of about 25 pages is probably the best contemporary picture of what good Catholic scholarship thinks about Scripture. And he starts off with saying, let's talk about the creation story. Some people read this story as saying that this means God gave us dominion and we are king of the hill and we can do whatever we want. And then he says straight out, this is absolutely not the position of our church. Now that's important. It's important because, not so much because when he says something that all the Catholics have to say, oh well, I agree. No, that's not the point. But sometimes, like 25 years ago, when I found this church and found out the seventh principle, that's why I became a Unitarian. I mean, That was an eye-opener for me. And unfortunately, our team wasn't doing anything on that. And several times I tried, you know, to organize groups. I tried offering to give talks. Nothing happened. So, the thing is that when the Pope makes a statement like that, the big thing it does is that, because I was told several times, I asked, you know, could I talk about this? Could I start a group? It said, well, that's, you know, you're this Mother Earth, sacred Earth, Mother, that, you know, this is not appropriate for Catholic thinking. Okay. But, you see, that was, you know, that was then, that was 25, but still. Once the Pope says it, once the Patriarch of Rome says it, then you can't say to me, that's not a Catholic position. It's not that I'm saying that is the Catholic position, but now it becomes legitimately a Catholic position. There's a lot of stuff in here that for a lot of people is going to be, oh, well, all right, I guess it's all right to go down that road. And that's a Greek thing. So on that, I'll read you. He just gave this talk down in Bolivia. And this is what he says. The most important task facing us today is to defend Mother Earth. Our common home is being pillaged, laid waste, and harmed with impunity. Cowardice in defending it is a grave sin. Cowardice in defending it is a grave